recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it or just downloading it to a device, an iPod, iPad, computer, and then listen to it whenever you want. Today we have a real interesting show, which I experienced personally back in 2002-2007 timeframe when I staffed multinational complex litigation matters in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And there's lots of talk in e-discovery about sourcing work to reduce costs. When that discussion occurs, usually the topic is focused on India, the Philippines, or other foreign countries. However, there's a trend occurring now in the United States, has been, of sourcing some work back from the larger cities to cities which have available lawyers at lower billing rates. So on today's show, we're going to talk about the Midwest sourcing trend, which we'll broadly define as most of the country in between the East and West Coasts, minus Chicago. We'll also include a sourcing using a firm staff attorneys or staff which reside in the Midwest as a source of talent to do review work, as well as contract attorneys who are found in the Midwest. So let's introduce the panel. So we've got a really good group for this topic. We've got Bob Trenchard, who's a partner with the Am Law 100 international law firm WilmerHale. He's based in New York City, but is chair of WilmerHale's e-discovery committee. He works with their Dayton, Ohio-based review center. Bob has maintained a litigation practice in New York for the past 15 years, where he's litigated civil and regulatory matters in federal and state courts, and before regulatory agencies, including complex domestic international contract disputes, antitrust matters, securities, commodities law and regulation issues, insurance, tort, telecommunication issues, a whole host of issues. He speaks regularly on e-discovery, and he's a member of the Sedona Conference Working Group on e-discovery. Kathleen Peterson is a discovery analytics of counsel and director of Works Document Review Center and an experienced litigator. She's, of course, with the International Am Law 100 law firm of Oryk and resident at Oryk's Global Operations Center in Wheeling, West Virginia, where much of their document review work is done. Kathleen specializes in e-discovery technology, privilege review, and discovery strategy. She's developed extensive strategies for ensuring document review team effectiveness, including testing, statistical analysis, second review quality control, privilege, and search strategies. And our final panelist, Dave Cohen, is a partner at the Am Law 100 international law firm K&L Gates, where he co-chairs the firm's e-discovery analysis and technology, known as EDAT Group, and set up one of their review centers in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Dave has over 25 years of commercial litigation experience in a variety of subject matters. He's authored numerous legal publications and is a frequent presenter at continuing legal education seminars regarding e-discovery technology and litigation tactics. I always like to mention, in November 2008, he was honored with an ESI Technology Champion Award at the Vestige Annual eDiscovery Awards Gala, because I think 15 minutes before he won, I won one too. So very prestigious, Dave. We got to stick together on that one. So that's the group. I'm really thrilled personally, having some biases, being an ex-New Yorker that lives in Pittsburgh, to be involved in this topic. But before I start, I always like to start my programs by asking how you got interested in electronic discovery. And Kathleen, since this is your first show, why don't you kick that one off?
Sure. Thank you, Carl. You know, I'll be dating myself by my response, but I first got involved in discovery back in the days when electronic discovery was basically boxes of scanned material that were reviewable on the Internet. And, you know, I quickly, as everyone who was engaged in it at the time, saw the vast inefficiencies and challenges raised by reviewing documents in that manner. And it became a passion, really, to find ways to do it better, to group it topically, to make the technology more efficient and make it work for us. And frankly, I also really enjoyed the collaborative nature of working to, with large groups of people with the same goal. So it's been a pleasure in this
industry. And Bob, since you were the first panelist, I'll let you.
Sure. Well, I'll give this brief introduction on a prior podcast. But I grew up surrounded by technology. My dad was CIO of Sony America, and my brother is a internet entrepreneur. And so I've been surrounded by technology. Although frankly, this is heresy on this call, I don't really like it very much, but I am comfortable with it, having grown up surrounded by it. And, you know, I was thrown in at the very beginning of my career to very, very large cases that presented these enormous logistical challenges. And so the combination of the need and the comfort level led me to, you know, get comfortable with the process of e-discovery in particular.
And Dave, yourself?
Well, Kathleen thought she was dating herself, but I'm really going to date myself because my first big document cases we were collecting by microfilm. We hadn't even gotten to imaging yet. So it was the typical story of a young associate in a big law firm, and the work that no one wants to do flows downward, and got involved in some very big document-intensive cases right when people were starting to computerize, prepare computerized databases of cases. So automated litigation support led to e-discovery, and now here we are 25 years later.
Almost like the Monty Python skit. Oh, I started earlier than you. Oh, okay. Luxury. Anyway, for those of you who know Monty Python, those of you who don't, I haven't lost my mind. It's a very funny bit. But Dave, we'll start with the topic here. What benefits do you look for when sourcing electronic discovery expertise?
Well, when you're looking to set up a low-cost review center for large-scale e-discovery review, I think you're looking at primarily the availability of a pool of talent. And, you know, one great thing about the Midwest, we've got a lot of great law schools in Pittsburgh and in surrounding areas throughout the Midwest. And right now there's a lot of lawyers who are willing to do this kind of work and interested in to do this kind of work. And the rates are low, so you've got low rates. You've got relatively low expenses in comparison to certain of the cities in the East Coast and West Coast. I think you also have a bit of a stability factor. We find that the people that we have doing this kind of review, many of them are there for the long run, and I think there are some other areas, again, somewhat in the West Coast, particularly the Southwest and the East Coast, that are much more transient areas where there's going to be more turnover, and I think reviewers get better with experience, and so those are all some of the factors that we look for.
Yeah, I recall when I had a 200-person project that ran for about 5 years, we didn't have a lot of turnover on ours because there weren't other big projects going on, and so you could retain people until you needed to get rid of them or they didn't perform right, which happens, of course, on all projects. So Kathleen, does location matter, do you think, when you're looking for review talent for e-discovery?
You know,
there are counter arguments.
Yeah, you know, in a couple of contexts, I think it does. You know, as Dave mentioned, I think having a location that's proximate enough to really high education centers, Oryx Global Operations Center in Wheeling, West Virginia, for example, is an hour outside of Pittsburgh and across the river from Ohio. So with that Ohio Valley focus, we can pull talent from West Virginia, from Pittsburgh, and other places in Pennsylvania, as well as Ohio. And I find that, you know, we get terrific, really bright, you know, very skilled attorneys. But interestingly enough, I don't know if that would be essential, because we also have another group of lawyers who may be retiring and moving on to a second career. They may have been, you know, a general counsel of a small company, and now they're moving, you know, more out to the West, or perhaps lawyers who are moving back to where they're from, even if they went to law school on the East Coast or the West Coast. So, you know, I find it's a really terrific mix, and although proximity to a large metropolitan base and great schools really helps, you know, there are probably other sources as well from what I've seen. You know, in terms of whether that's sufficient talent, for us, it absolutely is. I mean, there may be really unique cases. If you needed a vast army of, you know, securities lawyers who had done work with SEC investigations, you may look first to Washington, D.C. We tend to work with smaller, tighter teams, you know, although the work is very sophisticated in the Midwest as well. So there may be times when you'd look to a bigger city.
Okay. And Bob, we hear a lot about offshoring. I mean, that's typically, you don't think of the Midwest when you hear about this. You know, what are some of the barriers to effectively doing legal work offshore?
Well, speed and language and ethical issues, I would say, are the three, not necessarily in that order. Oftentimes dealing, you know, as Kathleen knows, actually, you know, we do a lot of the types of very, very fast SEC, FTC investigations, government-centered investigations, and coordinating with offshore review teams can slow the process down. It's just that simple. There's just more logistics involved in doing it. The process can be additionally slowed down and also just made more uncertain, depending on the nature or subject matter of the investigation. Lots of subjects are either technical or very idiomatic. You know, people use very idiomatic expressions, and you know, folks from overseas may be wonderful reviewers, but sometimes they just, it takes them a little longer to see things than people who are not overseas. And then, of course, there are ethical issues. Not this year, but at last year's Sedona conference, getting ahead of the curve discussion, Judges Grimm and Facciola actually both were quite concerned about the ethics, ethical implications of using large teams of offshore reviewers, both from the point of view of, you know, the attorney's duty to supervise and provide competent representation, and from the point of view of, are you engaging in the unauthorized practice of law in the foreign jurisdiction, both of which are live issues. There's a, that's actually, that last one is a very live issue in India. I believe that there's lawsuits about that issue right now in India specifically.
Yeah, you know, and funny, I, after I sold my company, I went on a journey to India to find my true inner self, well, partly, but I really wanted to see India, and it was interesting. First of all, I went to a review center, and I was very impressed with the technology, the depth of the types of people that were there, but I always felt from experience it was going to be project management that, that was their downfall. Lots of people are uncomfortable, and when messes happen in projects, you blame the person with the least power. They're an easy target. So I always thought there'd be hard difficulties for, in addition to the reasons that you gave, Bob.
And you know, some of them, in our experience, have wonderful project management capabilities.
Yeah.
Some don't. It's uneven.
Yeah.
But you know, but let's assume the top end, great project management, etc. Even those folks. You're going to have problems with speed and language, and particularly in highly technical areas. We do an enormous amount of patent work, for instance. Tough to get people who are really going to do that well.
The other thing that I was surprised to find out later on is that the legal degree is a two-year degree, or it's not an advanced degree, and a lot of people don't know that. You know, so you got to be aware of that. And then the last thing, I loved all the support and help I got traveling around the country. It's a great place to visit. I got to tell you, it was probably my favorite vacation I've ever had. But the word "I can't do this" isn't in the vocabulary of anyone I encountered, and that's sort of unfair. It's more of an aggressive cultural. I think that's very effective to be an entrepreneur, but in a risk-averse world like we live in legal, that can be a little scary. So I'm a big fan of project management and trying to find the most efficient ways to do it. But, you know, part of the reason to bring this Midwest thing into the topic of discussion is to have people considering other options. So, you know, where you may not have those same types of concerns. So if you think about it, Bob, it's sort of a follow-up question. You know, is economics a real driver of using the Midwest to find talent? I mean,
of course.
Did your strategic plan include Dayton as well as New York, California, Hong Kong, you know, Far East, and then Dayton?
It came to, in the sense that, look, I mean, cost of living is lower in the middle of the country than it is on the coast. It's pretty straightforward. And because of that, that means that you can get great quality people for less money than you can on the coast. And that does matter. You know, what we've done is, you know, we've built this Dayton center.
Mm-hmm.
It houses really two parts of the firm. One is a lot of back office functions, accounting, that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And another is we have, I don't know, about 40-ish or so discovery attorneys, we call them. And they are permanent WilmerHale lawyers. They don't leave, which is a very important fact, as I think David may have mentioned earlier. In conducting a review, it's nice to have the people who've done the review stick around so you can go back to them even years later to pick their brains about what it is they saw during the review. These folks are becoming masters of the high technology systems we're putting in place to do a statistical review and conceptual review and that sort of stuff, and will be consultants to the attorney teams in how to use all of that. And, you know, there's wonderful, wonderful talent in the Midwest at a very reasonable cost. There are, I have a list right in front of me of 20 or 30 law schools within 200 miles of Dayton. Of course, LexisNexis is right there, so there's a lot of folks who know an awful lot about legal technology. No comments about LexisNexis, please, but, you know, there are people there who know a lot about legal technology. And so we thought the combination of cost and talent, the total value proposition, to use the consultant's term, really made a lot of sense in Dave.
Great. Dave, why do you think we don't look more often to the Rust Belt in the Midwest for talent in e-discovery projects?
Well, I think that's something that is changing. I think that, you know, everyone's first reaction in the big law firms is to, you know, throw these projects at associates, or at least that was the old way of doing things. And then when clients imposed demands that they wanted to cut costs, or law firms got smarter about cutting costs, the first reaction was to go out and hire temp attorneys in whatever city they're already in. And I think it's a matter probably more of, you know, proximity than anything else. But I think the fact that you've got, you know, three top-thinking firms in Wilmer, Hale, Orrick, and K&L Gates that all have now set up busy review operations in the Midwest, and I think it's probably the same for all three. I can say for K&L Gates that, you know, a lot of the review work we get isn't even for cases that my firm's handling. It's corporations that have hired us as National Discovery Counsel, in some cases other law firms. So there's a growing recognition that this is the better way to do e-discovery review and cost savings, and people are realizing that, especially with today's technology, you don't need the review center to be geographically in your own office. You know, we've now got not only audio conferencing, but video conferencing and the ability to do webcasts and so on. So we feel like we can function as well and support our East Coast and West Coast offices, as well as other corporations and so on from Pittsburgh and our review center in Seattle, as if we were down the street a block away.
Kathleen, what are some of the challenges you face when you try to source work?
You know, I think I think the way that we have designed our document review facility actually helps overcome some of what otherwise could be challenges because of distance. Certainly the communication is key. Communication with the case team in structuring the review intelligently and making sure the attorneys have the proper background and communications access. Although Orrick is engaged on a fairly frequent basis to help supervise offshore reviews, communications is key there, and it's just harder. Now, when we're here in the United States, we've got video conferencing capabilities. You know, we're certainly close in time to the case teams we work with, so we're able to have that close level of integration. But really, it is the most important thing I find is the upfront work done in advance, both to make sure the technology is well suited and to make sure that the reviewers are well trained. You can have really smart attorneys sitting in front of computers, but if the advance work hasn't been done to batch the material intelligently, to give the proper deep background, then you're already crippling the output of that review. So, location in terms of West Coast versus New York versus D.C. or wherever, there aren't significant differences in challenges, apart from the fact that making sure the communications line, either video, teleconference, and, you know, making sure those questions and answers are rapidly fed to and from the case team, or that they're actually logging into the technology with you and in the trenches with you, is key.
Okay. And, Bob, isn't sourcing legal work something that we've always done? Just not necessarily to reduce costs, but to find expertise.
Sure, all the time. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, and at any given point in time, a firm will, I mean, you know, I think of WilmerHale, for instance, right? We have this incredibly robust regulatory practice in D.C. that some of the big New York firms don't have.
Mm-hmm.
So when a big New York firm is handling in a gigantic merger, mm-hmm. And they need help with FTC clearance, they'll come to us for help with the FTC clearance. And that happens all the time, obviously. You know, it happens overseas, of course, when you're dealing with multi-jurisdictional issues. And, yeah, we've always done that. You know, now with technology, you're looking for obviously a different sort of expertise. It's not purely legal expertise. You know, it's technological expertise. And, you know, look, this choice between offshoring and onshoring certain types of services in the legal industry, it's part of a broader group of choices that American companies are making more and more. You know, I mentioned at the beginning that my brother is an entrepreneur in Silicon Valley. His company, most recent company, is kind of called LiveOps, which does essentially, it onshores telephone answering that was previously offshored to the Philippines and India. And it does it by using creatively using technologies. The same forces at play there are at play here, which is for some time, you know, if you want someone to sell you a Ginsu knife, sometimes it helps them if they know the idiom of American argot. Whereas if you're just not managing a bank account, maybe they don't need to know that. And so these sorts of choices get made in a particular context, and we're just part of that broader trend. The flatter world, as I say.
Yep. I'm going to give Dave and Kathleen an opportunity. If you have any relatives with companies that you want to mention, feel free. I think it's got to be fair. But, you know, I was running my company, Legal Network, we were involved in a case, and there was a public model described. It was called the Baycall model, where you would split up talent among different firms and organizations, and you had your regulatory firm based in D.C., right. And the trial team, Bartlett Beck, was based in Chicago, and then the review work was based, housed through a firm which we supplied the lawyers to in Pittsburgh. And, you know, it's just intelligent sourcing.
And my point about my brother was not to make a plug for LiveOps.
Oh, go ahead. It's your brother. Sure, it is great work.
Like this audience is going to contract with him? I don't think so. But it's to illustrate. It's really part of a broader, you know, flattening of the world, to use Krugman's phrase.
Yeah.
And choices that get made, you know, outside of the legal industry as well as inside the legal industry.
Dave, we may have already covered this in one of Bob's earlier answers, but do you see any privacy concerns that are mitigated by keeping the work, with U.S. attorneys?
Sure. First of all, there's some data which absolutely can't go outside the country because of security classifications and so on. But you also do have concerns that you need to pay attention to. Obviously, you know, everybody's aware of the terrorist attack that occurred in India a year or two ago, which actually was very close to the data center of or at least one of the companies that does this offshore legal review. There have also been cases reported in the press where information has been sold by reviewers or leaked or held hostage. Of course, that can happen in the U.S. as well. Some feel that the likelihood is greater and there's less control if you're in India or the Philippines. Having said that, you know, I should mention there are ABA and other state court opinions which say that you can ethically have offshore people do legal review work, but as pointed out by Judges Fasciola and Grimm and these opinions themselves, including the ABA opinion, offshore attorneys aren't considered licensed lawyers under U.S. law. So anything that you do with them is subject to supervision and licensed lawyers in the U.S. taking responsibility for their work. And so what does that mean? What level of due diligence and further review is required? Some would argue that by the time you do the necessary due diligence and supervision and oversight, you're really not saving any money by using folks in other countries to do the review.
And, Carl, you know, the privacy concerns can work the other direction, too. I mean, you know, European privacy laws can force you to do a review in Europe that you otherwise might want to just do here.
No, that's true. Privacy is definitely a sensitive and growing topic, no doubt. You know, actually, the economics were interesting. When I was in India, I was no longer really working in the field anymore, so I had a rather open discussion, and I was amazed that the rates that they were billing out directly were very, very comparable to the rates I was billing in Pittsburgh. And, you know, so if you are price-driven, I used to joke that Pittsburgh was the next Bangalore, you know, back when I was trying to market the concept. And
Bangalore Steelers.
Yeah, Bangalore Steelers. How about that, Dave? The Steelers have an international audience. I wouldn't be surprised if the Steelers are number one in India. I know they are in Europe. But anyway, I just want to throw that in. Hey, Kathleen, sort of wrapping us up at the end in this particular area, do you have any advice you care to offer on how to effectively source legal work from the Midwest for those that might be considering it?
Yeah.
Your future competitors?
Carl, what was that last bit, Carl?
Your future competitors, I said.
You know, I think it's just a really smart way to address clients' cost constraints, to address the rising, you know, volume of discovery and how to get it managed well. That said, though, again, it's not just a question of finding facilities, finding computers, and finding bodies. And I know we all know that, but really matching the right technology, the right leadership, the right project management with that review facility is intensely important. The days of just throwing dozens or hundreds of bodies at a document review should be long past, because there are much better ways to do this now. And so, again, doing enough due diligence to understand what technology that provider plans to use, how they plan to strategize to group similar content and create efficiencies and reduce the room for errors, because human review is by its nature fallible. I think all of these are really essential. But again, as to the human element, there is plenty of talent in the Midwest at a terrific price. So I would encourage folks to really consider it seriously.
Great. And you segued into the next question, the final question, real well there when you talked about, you know, armies of lawyers. You know, that recent New York Times article that just came out, front page story about how inexpensive software is going to put armies of lawyers out of work. Are we looking at the next dilemma for the Rust Belt just as we got started here? Armies of lawyers in the Midwest now out of work, like auto workers? What's your take on that article in the New York Times, first of all, and how it plays in the sourcing? Bob, if you want to...
Sure. I mean, my first take was I was irritated because I'm in the middle of writing the same article for the New York Law Journal, but so they beat me to it. There's a bunch of folks who've come out in the blogosphere to comment on that article. I think Ralph Losi said that the premise that some of these advanced technologies are going to put lawyers out of work is maybe true with respect to contract attorneys, it will increase the importance and the economic leverage of lawyers who actually have technological sophistication and are willing to master the technologies and use them creatively. The technologies that are the subject of that article, and there's a bunch of them kind of mushed together in that article, not really talked about, you know, in a very technical way.
Some of them shouldn't have even met in the article.
Some of them should not. Exactly. There is that, too. Yes, that's absolutely right. They do, when they work, they actually offer the opportunity for great creativity, and they reintroduce in many ways a level of art to fact development that has increasingly been absent, at least in first level review, as armies of folks employ procedures more akin to, you know, early 20th century mass production to get through stuff, rather than to creatively engage with facts early in the case. I mean, that does happen, but it happened much later these days because of the volumes of data and crap you have to get through at the beginning in order to get to that point. Some of these new technologies are cool in that they allow you to do that much earlier and then get through the whole thing much more efficiently. We're firm believers in that. Obviously, the legal world has known about these technologies. They've been, you know, bouncing around for a few years now. And, you know, I mean, so the New York Times is a little late to the discussion. But I think that there, from the point of view of the legal marketplace, it will put some pressure on contract attorneys, I think. On the other hand, there are countervailing pressures, I mean, this ever-increasing volume of data. There's a whole bunch of other countervailing pressures. So it's very hard to predict, I think, exactly where that settles out.
I think the thing I agree with the most on that is there's a new specialty emerging. Mm-hmm. You know, people got to learn how to do this.
That's exactly
so,
right.
It's an opportunity. Change is good.
I mean, in our mind, it's good. It's to the extent that what associates have to do is learn how to investigate facts,
mm-hmm.
which is obviously the building block of everything we do for a living. Learning how these technologies work, learning how to use them together with statistical sampling to do efficient review, is part of the toolkit of what they have to do now.
Mm-hmm.
They have to learn that as an associate.
Yep.
Or as a discovery attorney or as a staff attorney.
And Kathleen and then Dave, you can weigh in too. If there's anything left to shoot at.
Yeah, I mean, I've been accused of being an eternal optimist, and maybe I am, but I view this intersection of law and technology to be more of an opportunity. I think, you know, while there will be some shift and transition as to what types of lawyers are doing what types of work, I view it as an incredible opportunity for attorneys in the Midwest and elsewhere to get familiar enough with the technology to know how to best leverage it to do really, really intelligent legal work for clients. I don't think it's going to put armies of attorneys out of business. I think what it's going to do is stop the inane, fairly brainless, straight, linear review that shouldn't be happening anymore. That discovery has advanced, and attorneys need to keep up with it, and I think those in many of the Midwest facilities, including those run by the folks on this call, are there already. So I view it as an opportunity.
Great. Dave, you want to close it out?
Sure. I agree with everything that Bob and Kathleen said, and I think you got to realize that there's two trends going on at the same time. One trend is, the software is getting better, and we're seeing the ability to do more advanced analytics and predictive coding, and even after enough documents have been reviewed, maybe the computer can take over. But we're not going to be doing away with human reviewers anytime soon. And beyond that, this is happening simultaneously with a continuation of the information explosion, so there's more and more stuff to review. So I think what's really happening is we're going to be able to do the review better and more efficiently and get to those key documents more quickly, but we're really not going to replace human review. I think Ralph Losey was one of those that he has a e-discovery blog and said that the New York Times got it right about the advanced the software advances, but got it wrong about that eliminating the need for the lawyers. You're really still going to need teams of talented lawyers in, and I think, as Kathleen pointed out and Bob pointed out, even more talented given the intersection between the technology and what lawyers have to do. So learning to use the technology most effectively to find the key evidence for cases.
Yeah, and I was happy that my podcast on the technical side predated the Times article by 2 weeks. And I'm just going to quote Professor Jaime Carbonell from the Machine Learning Center at Carnegie Mellon, which also was cited in the Times article. His conclusion is there's plenty of work. There's business will be good for lawyers. You know, the lawyer is the most important part of the whole process. The technology is still just a tool. Data forms are changing. You know, we're looking at the tools going through structured data, but as you look out on the cloud computing and different collaborative ways of communicating, there's so many challenges with even the new tools that await. There's no gloom and doom here. This is just changing opportunities for smart people to do better work for their clients. So sorry to have participated more as a co-guest rather than a moderator on this, but this is obviously I have biases and a strong opinion about this, so my apologies. And I'd like to thank Bob, Kathleen, and David for joining us here at ESI Bytes. It's always a pleasure to have you share your knowledge with us and our listeners. Hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you later this year. And to the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com for a complete list of our show. It sounds out, you know, if you're into sort of linguistics, easy bites, you know, an Indian might spell it as easy. I, you know, it's, if you remember Easy Byte, it's Evita ESI, you know, that's any other way to remember it. But however you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Juranov, wishing you a nice day.